And our current lesson this way. There is a law of three. If you're new enough to the community that you don't know what that is, it says this law, that three forces are necessary to move beyond the intractable fractures that we often find ourselves in, individually, interpersonally, and as a culture and as a society. Finding those third forces are necessary because basic human instincts predisposes us to really discern only two. We tend to find two of the forces, the affirming force, the reconciling force, the force that goes for something, the force that goes against something. But we don't find the third force, the reconciling force, that allows the two to then be integrated into a new reality. Well, if you missed those series of lessons, I'd encourage you to go back to the second week of July of this year, 2016, and just kind of listen to the next 4 or 5 weeks. It's an important foundational understanding. But I began this current lesson on the book of Amos this way. The law of three tells us that these reconciling forces are difficult to find, elusive, easily overlooked, even if they're right in front of us. But the law teaches us if we don't find them, we remain locked in these intractable divisions, caught up with instinctive brain patterns kind of moving us toward a for or against posture, getting caught up in combat between affirming and denying. So it behooves us, I said, to use all of the tools at our disposal to help us discern what those reconciling forces are. And one of them, I said, is the Bible. The problem with the Bible has been that it has been kind of misused in the last several generations. There has been a lot of throat shoving, I've said. There has been some over-promising and under-delivering. There has been some faulty thinking that has disappointed a lot of Christians because the Bible was set out to be something, and when we pursued it and found that it was not that something, we walked away disillusioned, disappointed. But I said, even though the Bible is not the thing that was often told us that it was, does not mean that it's not something and that something is not wonderful or sometimes profoundly helpful. And I use the metaphor of an eighth grade math book that has the answers in the back of the book. The answer in the back of the book doesn't give you everything, but it does help you check what you're doing, and it does kind of help point you to the way that this problem is going to unfold, and it helps you as a guideline discern better where those reconciling forces, where those third forces might be. And so I began a book on a lesson on the book of Amos to look for a potential third force to help us navigate this election season as faithful Christians in a toxic environment. So in a nutshell, Amos said this: you must honor the covenant that you inherited from your ancestors, the covenant of social responsibility one to another. There is, in a society that is functioning well, a deep commitment to solidarity with one another, the powerful standing with the powerless, the voiced standing with the voiceless, the rich standing with the poor. But, Amos told Israel, you've lost your way, and you have fractured into classes of people that are at odds with one another. Now, as prophets do, he was not polite about it, so he said, fix it now. And he got all up in their faces and said, go back to the ancient truth, go back to the ancient wisdom, and fix what has been broken. Which, I said last week, is not a message that any serious Christian disagrees with. It's the same thing Jesus said. It's a basic cornerstone of our tradition. So, nobody really fights about the message of the book of Amos, this cornerstone of our tradition, but we do get caught up in fights about something. We do get caught up in strong, afflictive, emotional reactions that go on exacerbated by the political environment, but actually, as we'll see today, something much deeper than what's going on today in this election. Sometimes the response comes out saying, well, it did in our own community, come out saying, all right, I heard what you said about Amos. Thank you, Grampy. By the way, you can call him Terry. We get to call him Grampy. So some of the response came back and said, okay, Doug, I want to be a little careful here because I'm not sure this is what I'm hearing. Are you saying that we should be giving our money away willy-nilly? Are you saying that that's what Amos is saying? Are you saying that we should do that without reference to what people actually do with the money? Are you saying that we should take money away from those who have worked very hard to earn it, and we should give it to those who are living irresponsibly? And are you talking about entitlements? And are you saying that we're talking about a Democratic platform then now clothed in sacred language, using the sacred texts? Is that what you're saying, that God wants us to forget all about personal accountability or personal responsibility? Which, if you've been paying attention, is a pretty well-rehearsed argument that is going on these days. It's broadcast about every day out there in the political arena, and it evokes an equally well-rehearsed rebuttal, which is also broadcast on a daily basis out there in the political arena. And you and I can't help but be affected by these powerful arguments that are going on around us, because they are the pool that we are swimming in, the air that we are breathing, the water that we drink. And so we do. We get stirred up by that argument, or 100 like it. We get stirred up against that argument, or 100 like it, because this is the world that we're living in right now. And a lesson that comes from Amos, or a lesson that comes from Jesus, has a difficult time getting through all the static without being derailed or hijacked along the way. So I spoke about Amos, and then I began to speak a little bit about our response and kind of our cultural response to the ideas of Amos. And then last week, I explored six foundations of human morality to help us perhaps figure out how to get through the impasse. And I noted that conservatives do an excellent job of integrating some of the foundations of human morality into policy and into worldview and into practice, and that liberalism does an excellent job of integrating other foundations of human morality into policy and into practice. And if you missed last week's lesson, I would encourage you to have a listen online. The take-home message was this. As we are trying to figure out how to be faithful to the way of Jesus in this American election cycle, our efforts are to keep our vision elevated to the larger themes of life and not get caught up in the fractious kinds of discussions that define us today. Our objective is to keep our vision elevated to the truths like loving neighbor, loving God, even loving enemy. And to do that while being limited by the hardwiring of our brains that we've been exploring, and how we get so easily derailed by instinctive knee-jerk responses from the spiritual mandate. Because as we've seen again and again, and as we're going to explore today, the default instincts of our brains often betray us. So we saw last week that one thing that religion does for us is help us to slow down and step back, take in the bigger picture than our instinct-driven brain tends to be able to see. And so we work the circle, as we've seen so many times. Helps us stay attuned to the ancient wisdom and to stay rooted in the interior divine self, and to not get sucked into our false self instincts and not get limited by the hardwiring of our brains. And so we take up these practices so that we can keep an elevated vision as we navigate our daily world. We also saw last week how our community, NRCC, is kind of set up to transcend the brain wiring squabbles that are bombarding us, because We have worked really hard together at a personal level and at an interpersonal level on understanding that our differences are actually our strengths. Our differences give us access to a broader swath of truth than we do when we're zeroed in together. What we explore together each week in those for those who are in Enneagram groups is that each of us has an instinctive aptitude for 1/9 of the divine essence, 1/9 of human wisdom. And we tap into that and we zero in on it and we work with it. We integrate it. We make it a substantial part of our lives. It is a great strength that we carry. But our very focus and the intensity that we bring to that 1/9 can't help but blind us to 8/9 of the divine essence. So what happens is we get together to help one another see our blind spots. So week after week, that's what we do. And the idea that people on different sides of the political spectrum have access to something that the people on the other side don't, well, that's just that same interpersonal dynamic now applied to a whole society. If we narrow our vision to either liberalism or conservatism, we cut ourselves off from a significant part of the foundations of human morality. And again, if you missed last week, we'll give you a better picture of what that sentence means. So that has to be the starting point of a quest to find third forces. That has to be a starting point for our quest to find the reconciling forces. We live in a political environment, and an important part of the political process is debate. We're not talking about that going away. And in order to debate well, you've got to be able to understand your case and make your case vigorously. That's an important way. We need to haggle over the details of how to make things better in our society. We're not talking about going away with that. We're not talking about becoming wishy-washy. We're not talking about not taking a position, not standing for it. That's not what we're talking about. We're just talking about the fact that we need to do that in an informed understanding. And our starting point for being informed is that we have to understand how easily we get blinded to other insights by zeroing in and focusing on the insights that we have. We get easily blinded to other insights because we have a knack for this foundation of human morality, and we don't tend to see the other foundations. Well, we can't have policy decisions, we can't have vigorous debate until our starting point is this: there might be something for me to learn from the other side. Well, today I want to use some different language to help us expand the upper brain, lower brain discussion that we've had before. I think we explored this upper brain, lower brain idea, which is really three brains, but we just simplified it to two. We did it, I think, once when we did the lesson on self-control. So in the book that I mentioned, The Righteous Mind, he used a metaphor that I thought was helpful. And it helps us to understand this kind of philosophical foundation of our society. Most of us studied practical stuff in school. Not very many people studied philosophy. So we know the name Plato and we know the name Descartes, but we don't realize how much these philosophers shaped how you and I bring instincts to everyday life. But we do. When Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am," he was expanding on a Platonic view of how humanity works. And they were in one camp, and David Hume was in another camp. They were in the camp that said, we have two parts, we humans. We have a rational part, we have a cognitive part, we have a reasoning part, and we have an emotional part, a visceral part, an instinctive part. And Plato, and then later Descartes, said the rational part is the master of the house and the visceral part is the servant. David Hume said it was just the opposite, said the visceral part, the passions, are the master and the reason is the servant. Well, to use the language that we've used in these other lessons, we have an upper brain and a lower brain, and we always work on the assumption that the upper brain is in charge, that the upper brain can tell the lower brain what to do. that instinctive, that visceral, that survive and thrive brain. The upper brain that can think these rational thoughts says, lower brain, shape up and fly right, assuming, yeah, that's going to work. And it doesn't. So neurobiology is helping us understand who won the ancient philosophical debate. And it was David Hume. Plato lost, and Descartes lost. The passions are the master. The emotion, the visceral part of us, is the master. Haidt uses this image. He uses the image of an elephant and a rider to describe the two brains. The elephant is the instinctive part of our brains, the lower brain. The elephant is the automatic part, the fast, the immediate, the instinctive part of our brains. And the rider is the reasoned part, the self-controlled, the conscious part. So when we respond to stimuli out there in the world around us, when we're navigating our days, it works like this. Intuition, instinct, the visceral passions, the passions as Hume called it, they come first. In other words, our elephant brain acts first. Our elephant brain experiences something out there and instantly evaluates it and instantly informs an initial response. And that process happens in microseconds, long before the upper brain even knows what's going on. So we make social judgments and we develop social strategies to respond to social stimuli in microseconds. And the same thing about political judgments and the same thing about moral judgments. These things happen in microseconds. And they happen so quickly because they are wired into us for instinct. Clearly, the predecessors who could respond this rapidly and make an action or response this rapidly survived better, and they passed their genes along to us. So, a stimulus happens, and our elephant leans in a microsecond. An instinctive judgment is formed in microseconds. A moral instinct is applied in microseconds. An initial strategy is acted upon in microseconds. It's only after the elephant has already formulated this evaluation and a strategic response that the rider even knows anything's going on. And usually the rider responds to coordinate with the elephant. Usually the rider responds to justify the lean that the elephant has already taken, or to tell a story about the lean that the elephant has already taken. So this is all MRI brain scan kind of stuff, and you should read the book. It's really interesting stuff. But here's the point. So those six moral foundations that we explored last week, they kick in quickly. They're elephant kinds of experiences. They are lower brain kind of experiences. So we have a response informed by those moral values, and we have them deeply, and we have them quickly. And it's only after that first lean, after that formulated evaluation and response, that the reasoned brain, the rational brain, the logical brain, the analytical brain goes to work. It's only after the elephant has leaned that the rider goes to work. Now, I don't like that. I'm imagining you don't like that either. I like to tell myself a story that I am a reasoned analytical person, that I'm not being driven around like Pavlov's dog, just being led by instinct. I don't like that formulation of our humanity, so don't blame me if you don't like it. Blame those damn neuroscientists. They're the ones that are telling us this is the way it is, this is the way our brains work. Now, to be sure, the rider matters. The upper brain matters. The rider can overrule the elephant. It can happen. The problem is, it doesn't happen very often because it's very demanding to do. It's very demanding to get our two brains to function out of sync with one another. So what usually happens is that the rider then begins to provide rational justification for the elephant's instinctive quick response. Usually what happens is our upper brains start providing a narrative, a story that we can tell ourselves to make it work with this instinct-driven response that our lower brains have already had. So, moral instincts, like the ones that support our political ideologies, are microsecond, instinct-driven reactions. The moral foundations that we draw from, the ones that shape our political instincts, are not really ideological. We love to think that they are, but they're more instinctive than they are ideological. Now, you can shape the way that your elephant leans over time, but it takes a long, long time. And it turns out, Haidt didn't say this in the book, but as I began to reflect on the book after I'd read it, I realized that's kind of what the spiritual tradition does for us. What the spiritual tradition does for us is train our interior microsecond instinctive responses, because that's what meditation does. That's what the working the circle does. That's what being in community and sharing our lives with one another does. It begins to give us a bigger picture. It begins to allow that to filter deeply in, but it filters in deeply and it filters in slowly and it takes a long, long time. Most of the time, we are living from the instinct-driven, rationally justified experience. So, the bottom line for us now, living in this political season, in this political environment, in this polemicized culture, in this fractured society, the bottom line for us is this. When someone says something political, or when someone says something social, or when someone says something on the other side of whatever divide you happen to be on, your elephant is going to lean immediately. Instincts are going to arise in microseconds. It's only after the fact that your rider brain is going to look for a way to support the way that the elephant has leaned. It has nothing to do with the efficacy of this moral foundation over this moral foundation. It happens to be with one, whichever one you happen to have a knack with, whichever one you happen to be wired for. So consequently, this brings hopefully a little bit of suspicion into the rightness, the justness, the righteousness of our cause when we sit there and cuss these two debaters on the TV as we're watching them. Because we might not have the whole picture. Our guts feel what is right or what is wrong immediately. Then reason constructs a justification for that feel long after the fact. Intuitions come first, strategic reasoning comes second. And it all happens automatically, it all happens instinctively. So here we are in pitched political battles, in pitched social battles, arguing and acting like our riders are in control. We argue with one another's riders. We make the case that our rider has made against the case that your rider has made, and we don't factor in one another's elephants. We don't factor in our own elephant, let alone someone else's. We usually don't listen deeply enough to understand what's actually going on. Instead, we ask one another to hear and be persuaded by our riders. So here's what our rider has done, is made a justification of a morally instinctive reaction. And so if we stand back from the process far enough, we can say, well, maybe my rider is never going to be able to convince your rider because they're both just justifying something that's going on deeply beneath the surface. We ask one another, when we ask one another to agree across the divide, we ask one another to violate our own interior consistency. We ask one another to violate our own deep intuitions. We ask one another to override our elements and buy the rightness of our rider. So we ask one another to override an instinct that is formed in microseconds, that's rooted deeply in an affinity for one or the other set of moral foundations, and then we're surprised when it doesn't go well. So last week, I encouraged you to be befuddled. This week, I'm going to encourage you to be a little suspicious. Be suspicious, yeah, that might not work. Now, over time, I am learning to listen to other people's elephants. I'm learning to listen not just to what they say, but what is it that they intuit deeply beneath what they say that I don't intuit? What do they capture in microseconds that I don't have access to? I'm learning to listen. I didn't always do that. I was usually convinced of the righteousness of my cause. Get out of my way. I'm good with words. Watch me just now eviscerate you. But in my Enneagram group, one of my friend's elephants, is always scanning for danger. If you're familiar with Enneagram jargon, she's a six. So she's always scanning the horizon, looking for danger. Now, I find danger scanning to be cumbersome because I am going somewhere, getting something done, and if I have to consider all the potential things that could go wrong, oh, shut up, we're going someplace. I have another friend's elephant who is very gentle, attuned to how an action might affect other people. My elephant is not so attuned. All that stuff gets in the way of moving forward. It creates too much complexity. I can't consider all those things. I just have to figure it out. Is it right or is it wrong? Is it good or is it bad? Okay, if it is, here we go. You know, Katie, bar the door. The problem is, I really need to see all that stuff. And I have learned enough over time, I really need to have access to all that other stuff. So when I only see the other people's riders and I don't pay attention to their elephant, I only listen to their words, and honestly, their words sometimes I find a little bit draining. More than once, I'm sure they've seen me roll my eyes, think, oh God, are we going to talk about that again? But what I need is what's underneath the surface that they access in microseconds that never occurs to me. Because I need to listen past the story that they tell to find out what is the instinct there and how does it form the broader picture. That's the kind of stepping back that the spiritual journey invites us to experience. That's the kind of stepping back that we do when we work the circle and we get into deep communal relationships and we practice contemplative and we learn and when we serve something bigger than ourselves. That's what the tradition does, is it helps us stand back from our instinct-driven, righteous cause-driven understanding of the world that so limits us, that allows us to not see the broader picture. Because diversity really is our strength if we can access it. The tradition invites us to learn and to respect and to honor one another's elephants and to listen to something that is bigger than our own limited perspective. Since we tend to only access our own riders, not even our own elephants, our own mental constructs that we've made in a microsecond response on the basis of a moral foundation that we favor, we assume that what we've got in the story that we tell is the one and true truth. And that's not to say that there isn't truth to it. That's not to say that we can't make a great case for it. But it is to say that when we go toe-to-toe with someone else who has a different elephant and has formulated a different narrative on the basis of those different instinctive responses, that we might not learn something from them if we were to be able to access both. So again, hopefully what you hear today is an invitation not to being wishy-washy, but to being slightly suspicious. Suspicious of your one and true truth, and suspicious that your one and true truth might not be the only story that there is. Those of you who weren't looking, you missed it. It's really funny. Hopefully you'll be suspicious of your ideas and your ideologies, but hopefully you'll also be suspicious of the other person's ideas and ideologies. Suspicious of your rightness, because that's going to be the default setting, and suspicious of their wrongness, because that's also going to be the default setting. Becoming suspicious of our default settings, because we might not have the whole picture. Suspicious that the other might have intuited something that we haven't. We've got some big, big issues if we're going to respond to Amos. If we are going to listen carefully to what Amos says and stand in solidarity, rich with poor, and by the way, we are all rich. If we're going to stand in solidarity, privileged and unprivileged, If we're going to stand in solidarity, voiced and unvoiced, we've got to figure out a lot of things, because usually what happens is the argument starts, everyone agrees in the principle, the argument starts, and then it stops because it's too complex, because I can't get you to believe what I see. We've got some big issues as a society and as individuals that we've got to solve. And so we need a full toolbox. And the fight or flight approach that we bring, this brain chemical approach that we bring to our political discourse right now, is not sufficient. The other may not even be making a good rational case for their instinctive visceral response. And so we might need to help them. We might need to extend ourselves beyond ourselves to try and find out what's going on beneath an argument that is being poorly made. What is the instinctive response that needs to be heeded and heard? We might have to do some detective work to figure out the moral foundation that goes with any particular argument. Amos's message was one of social solidarity. His message was one of standing, voiced with voiceless, powerful with powerless. And again, as we've said, no serious Christian argues with that. It's a core foundation of our faith. So when we're not doing that, what is it that we're caught up in? And usually when we're not doing that, we're caught up in the thing that is under the thing, as we saw last week. We're usually fighting rider to rider, and we can't make any progress, because we haven't paid attention to our own elephants, and we certainly haven't paid attention to one another's elephants. And that's what our religion invites us to do. Now, again, as I've said in the past, I am not unaware of how poorly our religion is doing at this right now. But that doesn't mean that that's not what we're here for. That doesn't mean that that's not what we're to do. It is our mandate to step back, have the prophets help us step back, have working the circle tenderize our hearts so that we can step back and access a bigger truth. I said it last time that it is the way of the prophet to piss us off. That's just what they do. They get in there and they challenge us, and they are not even gentle about it or polite. They call our riders blind and they invite us to see our elephants. But as we practice our religion and as we work the circle, hopefully our hearts become tender enough and that we can quiet our reactionary responses enough that we can hear the wisdom even if it comes from our enemy. Now that's a whole bunch of background and that's a whole bunch of context, and I think context helps. So I give it to you all the time. But let me just bottom line it for you. If you want to apply the wisdom of religion to daily life, if you want to apply the insights of neurobiology to your daily life, if you will just undertake this one simple spiritual practice articulated for us in the prayer of St. Francis, you can get all of this stuff that I've said in this easy-to-remember approach. Lord, may I first seek to understand and then be understood. May I first seek to understand and then be understood. Again, I'm not arguing for wishy-washy. I'm not arguing for you not to hold firm convictions and to make a case and to be part of the political process. I'm just saying, don't be stupid about it. Be informed. Understand the bigger picture. The invitation is to understand the basket of deplorables. The invitation is to understand those socialists who are feeling the burn. The invitation is to understand, what is the story that they're telling? What are the instincts that their elephant is accessing that ours does not? So given how complex our interior processes are, what are they thinking? What are they feeling? What are they responding to that they may not even realize? We could go the extra step. Offer the gift of listening. Offer the gift of understanding. The gift of listening beneath their rider to the instincts that are rooted in some dimension of human morality. Now, granted, a whole lot of people's riders are acting very immorally these days. And again, we don't do our best when we're in emotionally charged situations like this one. But there's an instinct in there. There's a leaning elephant in there somewhere. Lord, may it be that I seek first to understand and then be understood. There's a simple principle Jesus taught. It says, give and it shall be given unto you. Here's the issue. What if I go do all the understanding and they don't? Yeah. Well, the principle is you give, and the probability that it will be given unto you is greatly enhanced. If you give the gift of listening, if you give the gift of understanding, if you listen, if you understand, if you look past your own writer's reactions, if you understand yours and then you understand theirs, and if you give that gift, it dramatically increases the possibility that you will be listened to in turn. Doesn't guarantee it, but it increases the possibility that you will be listened to in turn. The converse is, don't give the gift of understanding. Don't give the gift of listening. And the chance that you will be listened to in return is dramatically decreased. So, if you listen, if you understand, you enhance the possibility that you will in turn be listened to and understood. And if you want some practical tools to help you, and if I haven't yet already overwhelmed you with books that you should read, here's another one. You've heard me talk about this one in the past, Nonviolent Communication, Marshall Rosenberg. It'll just give you some very practical tools to help you listen first, seek to understand first. Holy Spirit, may we be listeners. May we be learners. May we be self-aware, but may we also understand others. May we be faithful to our deeply rooted convictions, to our own elephants. But may we also understand the bigger picture and understand one another's elephants. And may we do so all the while without participating in the ugliness that is going on around us, in our families, in our neighborhoods, in our social context, on our social networks. May we be able to bring light into darkness. May we bring wisdom into foolishness. May it be so in us. May it be so through us. In Jesus' name, amen.